Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we continue our series of survivor stories with guest host Peter LaMoth, a cancer survivor himself. Peter's guest this week is Paul Buchanan, who was diagnosed twice with melanoma.
Why don't we get started by you telling us a little bit about your cancer diagnosis?
Well, my original diagnosis, and I've been diagnosed with melanoma twice. My original one happened just over almost 16 years ago now, 15 years ago actually. I was just shy of 35, and I had I had what I thought was a simple mark on the back of my leg. I didn't really think too much about it. A wart, actually, is what I thought it was. Finally, ended up going to a dermatologist. Had it there for a number of years. Went to a dermatologist and had it taken off. Didn't really think anything of it. Didn't know anything about melanoma. Had no concerns about it whatsoever. Received a call a couple days later from him informing me that it was melanoma. Really didn't have a clue as to what melanoma was at that point. I don't think it was as prevalent or as advertised, I guess, as it is today. So it was a bit of a surprise. I think my first question, I called one of my brothers and said, "Is melanoma a bad thing?" And he was like, "Are you kidding?" You know, yeah. It's definitely not a good thing.
And where were you living at the time?
I was living down in White Plains,
okay.
New York.
And we had a family?
Yes. My family was, it's where I grew up. My whole family was from down there.
Okay, terrific. What was your initial reaction when you got this news, besides calling your brother? I mean,
you know, it, again, lack of information was big. You know, I really knew nothing about it. I had people calling me within days of my diagnosis telling me, you know, what they had read on the internet, and I went on and looked at some stuff, and I found out pretty quickly I really didn't want to look at the internet to see what melanoma was all about, because the prognosis, being diagnosed with melanoma, the prognosis was not very good, and probably was worse 15 years ago than it is today.
Right.
It was a shock. I'd been married for about 2 years at this point, still didn't have any children, thought I still had a lot to live for, wasn't really appreciative of being diagnosed with it, I guess.
Right. When cancer patients are diagnosed, they often are surprised, just like you. But after learning a little bit about the disease, they learn that there are some signs that appear before diagnosis. Was there anything that you were able to, say, connect dots in the months or year or so leading up to the diagnosis?
No, yeah. It was the fact that wart, you know, underneath that wart was a mole. It was something I should have had taken care of, you know, probably 2 years before. It had grown to the point where it had grown deeper into the skin, and the odds that it had metastasized to my lymph nodes was pretty high.
Mm-hmm. You know, so what were the next steps that you took after the diagnosis?
Besides the panic, I immediately the next morning called my doctor, my general guy that I had gone to, family doctor I'd gone to for a number of years. He recommended a surgeon in White Plains that I went to, a Dr. Gordon. Great man. Went to see him. He did the surgery. Ended up finding out that the cancer had spread to a couple lymph nodes in my groin. And then he immediately recommended I go down and talk to folks at Sloan Kettering and also at NYU, because they were both currently running experimental programs.
Okay.
Ended up going to Sloan Kettering. Their program wasn't currently running. They were going to start it up again in January. This was September now, and they were running their program starting it in January. He didn't give me a very good prognosis either. I was pretty much wanted to know, you know, what are my chances of survival, and he was very blunt. You know, he told me to get my affairs in order.
Wow.
That I probably didn't have more than a year to live. I went down and visited a Dr. Oratz down at NYU. And they had a program running, and I asked her the same question. Not that I had any other options at this point, but I asked her the same question. And she felt I had a better than 50-50 chance of survival.
So you went from get your affairs in order, 50-50 survival, to being here now many years later talking.
Yep.
What happened next? What type of treatments did you receive? What was the course?
It was an experimental program that they were running. And I needed to go down. Don't know what the protocol was called or what it was called, but I had to go down about every 3 weeks, twice a week during that period. Every 3 weeks, and had to go down two successive days, one to get injected in four different locations on my body, just simple pricks under the skin, an injection of they were working on a vaccine that they thought would help. And then had to go down the next day to see how, you know, what had happened with the treatment. They did some measurements on the spots to see where it was. Went through that program, went through that protocol for almost 5 years, 4.5 years actually. And at the 4.5 year mark, the FDA actually pulled the program.
Wow.
So I never really knew. And I was actually in the blind test. And so I didn't know if I was getting the vaccine or if I wasn't getting the vaccine. And I think after about a year or so, I called down there and actually spoke to the woman who always checked me in every morning. And she just said to me, she goes, "Paul, you were definitely getting it." She goes, "I can just tell you." And, you know, but I never heard officially from anybody. But I guess the fact that, you know, I was very fortunate. I never had another sign of the cancer after that. It, mm-hmm. there had been no spread, any subsequent exams, scans, anything, nothing for 9.5 years.
Wow. So after the diagnosis, your treatments begin, last a considerable period of time, and at the same time, you want to be living life as normally as you can. Can you say a little bit about, you know, how you did get on with your life?
Yeah, in the beginning, it was hard. Again, as I said, relatively young and didn't have any children, married for 2 years. You know, trying to be strong, you know, for my wife, for my mother, my brothers, my family. You know, I probably pretty much internalized a lot of stuff. I found, you know, I was a sales guy on the road. I found pretty much that I did a lot of my thinking about it and then a lot of my crying about it, you know, when I was by myself. But then over the course of time, as the years went on, time went on, never forgot about it. You know, never could because it was part of my life. But I moved on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was there. I still went religiously, you know, every 6 months and every year, you know, after 5 years for my scans. And, you know, again, never had a sign, never had an issue, never had a problem.
So what did you tell your family and how do you think it affected them? And you did a lot of thinking and crying on your own. What do you think in private their response was, or the conversations that they had that you weren't a part of?
You know, my wife was a nurse for 40 years, and, you know, she knew what the disease was all about, and, you know, I'm sure she didn't quite think I was going to make it through it. I don't think, you know, she always kept telling me, "No, God only takes the good people, Paul. You don't have to worry about it." And I was like, "Thanks, Mom." You know, I think everybody just kind of waits and holds their breath.
Yeah,
it's, you know, again, I didn't have any other outward signs. Nothing had ever happened again.
Right.
You know, it wasn't as if I had to go in and every few months they were taking stuff off of me or, you know, discovering things on scans and I was having real issues. My life went on.
Okay.
I had to go on.
Right.
You know, I tend not to be the type of person that looks back. I like to look ahead,
mm-hmm.
you know, to things that are going to come.
And so then after this, you began to have a family and mm-hmm. got on with your career.
Yeah. We actually put it off. I mean, after your initial diagnosis, we had, you know, we were trying. And when I was diagnosed, it was kind of like, well, you know what, maybe we'll just wait. And we waited a couple of years,
yeah,
you know, just to make sure everything was okay. And then we moved forward.
And how old are your kids now?
My daughter is 10 and my son is 8.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. So how did you, I know that you're a member of the melanoma support group at Yale, and I want to talk a little bit about that, but how did you come to get involved with that?
It was, you know, I'm trying to think back to when it was. I think Dr. Schnall had mentioned it to me, that they were looking at putting a group together and whether I'd be interested in, you know, in getting involved. And I definitely was. I was one of the charter members and had gone to a number of the initial meetings. It's a group where survivors and spouses or significant others come together, you know, to sit and to talk, you know, whether it's to openly discuss what issues you had, what problems you had, what you were going through, mm-hmm. you know, to open up maybe, to see what other people's experiences were, to just even sitting back and talking about other programs that are going on, whether it's here at Yale or NIH or University of Pittsburgh or wherever it would happen to be.
And did your wife attend with you?
No, my wife. My kids are relatively young. This was something that they starts at 6 o'clock, I believe it is, and runs until whenever it's really over. So it's really time for my kids to get down to either doing homework or getting ready for bed. Right. They have it on Thursday nights.
And how do you feel that it benefited you personally?
You know, I've never had any issues talking about my disease and what's happened in my life. I've always felt that the more I get it out, maybe if I can help one person, you know, it'd be worth it. I went there to help other people more than anything else. My wife thinks I'm crazy, but I didn't, you know, this one I didn't really internalize, you know, this last time I was diagnosed, you know, being diagnosed the second time. I just felt I needed to talk about it from the outset, and I didn't internalize it. And I was very open and, you know, fair with my feelings towards, you know, letting people know it and see it, so.
What, I think that there are, that cancer survivors would agree that giving back the obligation of the cure is something you hear sometimes to those people who are going through cancer or who are having a difficult time in survivorship. So what do you think through this group that you were able to bring to individuals that were having a difficult time or, you know, were facing a somewhat uncertain future or trying to make sense of the trauma that had visited their lives?
You know, as I said, it's when people look at melanoma and they read everything about it on the internet, it's you know, prognosis usually isn't very good. And you know, having, whether it's me or some of the other folks that are in the group, you know, being survivors and not just, you know, a year or 2 years, but long-term survivors, I think it helps them look at us and say, okay, I have hope. You know, that's the big thing.
Dr. Mario Snoll is the co-director of the melanoma program at Yale, so he both sees patients and also conducts research in the disease. How did you get hooked in with him?
Oh, by luck. I was actually going to see a doctor, Dr. Tanzino, up at Midstate, and he had recommended Dr. Snoll and the second time that I had been diagnosed. And I, for some reason, I just, whether it was my insurance or something going on, I just couldn't get the appointment with him. And then, lo and behold, you know, when I'd become deathly ill, really very ill, you know, we were able to get the appointment with him and came down and saw him.
Mm-hmm. And when was that?
That was in September of 2005.
Okay. And how much time had elapsed between the first diagnosis and the second?
It was right at 10 years.
So what did you think when you were told the second time?
It was funny. When I was initially told I had a tumor that had developed in the leg, went through my scans, nothing popped up. Didn't really think it was much of anything. Had the lump taken out, same leg that I had the original one in, and it came back full-blown melanoma. And I never really went through a panic thing. I just said, you know what? My immune system has been good over the last 10 years. You know, I'll beat this. I'm confident I'm going to beat it. You know, I'll just see what I need to go through, mm-hmm. What kind of protocols are going to put me through. But it rocked me. It came on. I mean, I was at a sales meeting one week, giving a presentation. That following Monday, I could barely get out of bed. Following Tuesday, I was down at Yale. So a week and a half, almost 2 weeks later after that sales meeting, I was down at Yale, barely able to walk or talk.
So what did you tell your kids by this point? You had two children.
They didn't really. So they were young, three and six, actually. My son's birthday was just coming up. They didn't really know what was going on. They thought my original sign that there was a problem was I had some real pain in my back. Yeah. Serious pain in my back. Went through chiropractic care. Went through physical therapy, and they just thought it was my back.
Really? So they just thought Dad was in some pain. He wasn't very, very sick.
Yeah. No, we weren't gonna spring that on him. It wasn't until a couple of years ago at a Relay for Life. I've been involved in that since my last diagnosis, and I was wearing the purple shirt. And my kids kind of looked at my daughter kind of looks at me. And she goes, "Why are you wearing the purple shirt, Daddy?" I said, "Well, I've been diagnosed with cancer twice," and she just was dumbfounded. I don't, you know, she was shocked, and wow. my son was there, and he was, really, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, so we talked a little bit about it and what the realities of it were.
Wow, that's very powerful. Let's come back to that after we take a break. We're going to take a short break now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to hear more about Paul Buchanan's story of survivorship.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and over 2,000 new cases will be diagnosed in Connecticut alone. One in six American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses three-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Peter Lamoth, and I'm joined today by Paul Buchanan, and we're discussing his story of survivorship. Paul, before the break, we got into the beginning of your second diagnosis and how you came to know Mario Snall at Yale. So can you say a little bit more about what the next steps were after the second diagnosis and what happened?
I became sick very quickly. It was pretty dramatic. You know, over a two-week span, I went from being at a sales meeting, giving a presentation, to being at a point where 2 weeks later, I was at Yale seeing Dr. Schnall, and he put me in a hospital that day. I'd become so sick. I could barely talk. When I walked, I shuffled my feet. That's the best I could do. I couldn't really lift my feet. And he saw me, and he just kind of looked at me at one point and said, "We're putting you in today." He goes, I want to treat you, but you're not strong enough to be treated. We need to get you stronger. We need to put you in. So I went in. They put me into Yale for, I think it was a Tuesday, and they let me out on Saturday. And their whole thing was to see if they could get me strong enough, you know, to go through the interleukin-2 treatment. I don't think Dr. Schnall thought I was going to be strong enough to do it. I think my guardian angel at that point was Dr. Kluger. She came in at one point. She had young children. She had seen them. I think she was there, had seen them in my room. And she kind of looks at me at one point. She goes, "We're going to treat you." She goes, "I've made the decision. We're going to treat you." She goes, "Now I just got to go up and tell Dr. Schnall." And it was really because of her that I went through the IL-2 treatment, and they were able to give it to me. I mean, as I found out later from Dr. Schnall at one of my appointments with him, you know, their choices weren't too many for me. It was either IL-2 or put me into a hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And because I didn't think I'd be strong enough for the IL-2, he was leaning towards hospice.
So what was done to get you stronger so you could have the IL-2?
Just get fluids into me, you know, just to get me, I guess, just to get fluids into me more than anything. I'd become so dehydrated, I really wasn't eating just anything. They kept checking just to make sure I was strong in the feet and my arms. It was kind of surreal.
So you had a team of people here at Yale that were working with you.
They were awesome. Yep.
Okay. And so you went on IL-2, and what happened?
It was pretty amazing. I felt like it was working almost right away.
How did you know that?
No, the lump that they had taken out of my thigh, you know, a couple months earlier, you know, had come back. It had grown pretty significantly again, and I was in bed probably after my first or second treatment of IL-2, and I just kind of reached down to the thigh, and it just felt like it had gotten smaller. You know, I had some swelling, you know, things that happened because of the treatment, but it just felt like it was smaller. And Dr. Tanzino, I'll never forget, he came, Dr. Tanzino is the doctor from up at Midstate. He came into my room, and he was on rounds one morning, and he came in, and he just had a sad look on his face when he looked at me. I'd seen him for about 5 years, and he just kind of looked at me, and I said, Doc, I think it's working. And you could just see the doubt in his mind. I said, I'm telling you. I said, this lump is getting smaller. I think it's working. Nobody believed me. You know, nobody could. You know, they were still going through scans, still doing some stuff. They saw the cancer. You know, the cancer was in my bone marrow. There was cancer in the spine. You know, I was basically a mess. And then I got stronger over the course of time. And it was after my next round of treatments, which were in, late November, I kind of looked at Dr. Schnall and said, you know, I want to go through some physical therapy. And he kind of looked at me like, well, you want to what? I said, I want to go through physical therapy. I said, I lost all my muscle. I said, nothing left to me. I'd lost 50 pounds. Ended up doing it for a month. then had to go back in for treatment again.
So you're pretty. Were you a sort of physically fit, physically active guy before these two episodes? Or
I was when I was younger. Yeah. More so, but it was just something I just knew I had to do for myself.
Okay.
You know, it was a choice: go home and lay in bed.
Okay.
Or get out of bed and go do something.
So you felt, and I think that many cancer patients and survivors who are listening to us are probably nodding their heads, saying, "You know, I could tell when it was working too," and it's hard for doctors, and I think doctors are of the mindset that they should be cautious, and that's great. It's good for us, but you know your body, and you can tell when something's working. Mm-hmm. How long was it before the doctors knew that it was working and that you were going to come out of this?
It wasn't until the end of January that following year. I was feeling pretty good, went in to see him. They gave I think it was between a 6 and 7, maybe even an 8 week break in between treatments with the IL-2 just so you could get your body get back going, and because it impacted so much your liver, your kidneys and such. And
say a little bit about that, Paul. What is the impact after you have your treatment? What are you feeling like? What are you doing?
Oh, man. It's funny. I was warned. You know, Dr. Schnoll obviously gives you a warning. It's almost like watching those commercials about prescription drugs where it's going to basically impact everything and even give you psoriasis, you know, as you're going along. And he told me, you know, there could be a chance I could be put into the ICU if it impacted my liver or kidneys. I mean, they were basically drawing blood or taking blood about every 15 minutes when I was in the hospital just to make sure everything was okay.
And what was the length of your hospital stints when you were being treated with IL-2?
There were 4 separate weeks that I was in doing the treatment. And it really, I was in as long as my body could tolerate it. First time, I think I was in for 5 days. I think I made about every treatment they wanted to give me. Second time, I think I was in maybe for 4 days or 4+. And, you know, and then as I went for the third treatment and fourth treatment, I think the fourth treatment, my body just couldn't deal with it. I don't think I was in for more than 2.5 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was hoping to get more out of it, you know, to pump more into me, but it just didn't work out that way. And, you know, as far as getting back to, you know, what the doctors saw or what they felt, I went back in after that break. I went back in to see Dr. Schnoll, and he kind of looked at me and goes, you know, he goes, we had a vote on whether or not we were going to put you through another round of treatments. And, you know, he wasn't sure another round was going to be helpful or not, but he goes, you know, we're going to put you through another round. And I looked at him and I said, oh, please. I said, don't, you know, I said, please don't. You know, I was kind of begging him. Here I was feeling good. I knew it was working. I knew it had worked. And I was begging him not to put me through it again. Because the IL-2, when they gave it to you, as you felt better going into the IL-2 treatments, the IL-2 treatment just tore you down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just tore you up and tore me up pretty bad to the point that after being in there, it would be about a week before I would actually be moving and doing the things I needed to do. So he goes, we voted on it, so we're going to put you through it. And I said, well, how'd you vote? He goes, I voted not to. I said, well, it's good enough for me, you know, and he kind of laughed. He goes, well, I'll tell you what. He goes, you go through your scans again. He goes, we'll do another bone marrow biopsy. He goes, if you're clean. He goes, we won't do another round of treatments. I said, what do you think the odds of that are? He goes, not very good. That's all right. So I went, did my stuff.
Yeah.
Went down to see Dr. Schnoll, you know, sat in there waiting for him. And he came in, he just looks at me, he goes, I can't believe it. Because there's no sign of cancer in your body at all. I mean, I went from when they did the first bone marrow biopsy where they misdiagnosed, that the lab had misdiagnosed me with myeloma. And he went back and said, no way, because we know it's melanoma. And the lab came back and said, oh, you're right. He goes, he doesn't have any bone marrow left. It's 100% tumor. So I went basically from, you know, my bone marrow being, well, no bone marrow, being 100% tumor, to not having anything in me 5 months later.
Wow. So 2-time cancer survivor, 2 pretty harrowing experiences with a period of time between each of them where you had children, you moved on with your career and your life. But coming out of cancer the second time, how is it different, and how are you leading or living your life differently now as a result of these 2 profound cancer experiences?
You know, I think people go through them in a different way. I'm not sure I ever really had. I mean, you read a lot of stuff about people having that epiphany, you know, where they just saw something and, you know, they went on and did some things. I mean, for me, you know, I had a young family, had to get back to work. I mean, I was back working a month later, you know, traveling, doing the things I needed to do to support my family. You know, it's going to be a part of my life. It'll be a part of me forever. you know, it'll be part of my children forever too, because now, you know, forever we have to watch and make sure they don't go through the same thing I went through. I'm not sure that, you know, change for me has been as profound maybe as it has been for other people. I just want to live every day.
Right.
And, you know, and make it through and do what I need to do.
So what do you say then, Paul, to other people who you know that have gone through this experience, people you talk to in the support group, or people who are listening now, you know, at home, driving in their car, you know, what do you say to them?
If, you know, I wish I had known more about melanoma the first time around, and I wouldn't have had to have gone through the experiences I had gone through. If there's a strange mole, even if you don't think it's a strange mole, you know, go have it checked. You know, I mean, to go just to see a doctor, just to have something looked at is not a big deal. And it could save your life. Not only can it save your life, it could save you a lot of heartache, a lot of trouble, a lot of issues, you know, going forward. And listen to the doctors. There's a lot of stuff out on the internet, different treatments, different places. And you know, I just put my faith in the doctors, put my faith in God, and, you know, that I'm going to get through it. And that's what I did. You know, that's what I needed to do, you know, at the point where I was, especially the second time around.
Yeah. It sounds like you also had a close-knit, supportive group of people around you who helped you with your cancer, but also just helped you with who you were. I'm sure you didn't talk about cancer all the time when you got together with your buddies or your family. We know how profoundly the cancer impacts the patient, but it also has an impact on their family, their friends, their coworkers, their neighbors. And many people believe that they need certain levels and types of support too. Say a little bit about your own personal experience with your family and friends.
Yeah, I think it's harder on family than it is on the patient. You know, I mean, I hate to say it, but I came to a point where when I'd gotten so sick, you know, I had known over the course, you know, after my first round of treatments, and I had been told pretty bluntly that if the melanoma had ever come back, I probably wouldn't survive it. And when it came back so fiercely, I kind of had gotten to a point where I kind of figured I was going to die. You know, I was okay with it. You know, I didn't want to die, but I was okay with it. But I had a 79-year-old mother who came up to help us. And one of my brothers came up and lived with us. I had my two children. I didn't want to die. But you could see the impact that it had on the people that knew what was going on around you. You know, no parent wants to see a child die before them.
Right.
Ever. You know, it's just not part of it. Nor there's a brother, nor there's a wife, you know, nor do the friends or anybody else. You know, my support group on the friend side of it, you know, we'd only lived in our neighborhood for just over 3 years. It was a new neighborhood. It was a new development. And people really came together. It was unbelievable. I mean, there was stuff that needed to be done, you know, whether it was mowing the lawn, cutting, you know, bushes or hedges or, and, you know, I had friends that came over and did everything that they could. You know, they supported my wife, helped with the kids. You know, the kids, my kid, you know, their life had to go on. You know, just because I was sick didn't mean that they weren't going to go to swim practice or they weren't going to go to, you know, to the gym, to the YMCA for their programs there. I mean, they needed to stay focused and stay level with their life. And I always felt it was harder for them than it was for me, mm-hmm. You know, to watch me, you know, to go from, you know, where I was a very healthy, you know, 45-year-old man to really just had lost 50 pounds and wasn't even an image of my former self.
Yeah. So Paul, we have just about a minute left, and this is kind of a difficult question, I think, to answer because it could be answered in so many different ways. But if you could say something to cancer, what would you say?
You know, for my own experience, I kind of look at it and say, you know, if it's going to come again, you know, just bring it on. I'll deal with it. I think we all need to deal with it. It's never going to be easy. The diagnosis isn't going to be easy. The treatment more than likely isn't going to be easy. And the time moving, you know, as you move forward, it's going to be difficult for everybody. I would like it to just go away. Go away. Leave us alone.
Paul Buchanan and Peter LaMoth are cancer survivors. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.